This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're in the studios of the Library of Congress with Kimberly Taylor. It's always a good time to celebrate a debut book, and we're going to do that today with a new collection of poems. Here's Kimberly.
Extravagant Captivities. What do I do with this will to lie on a red couch, satin covering nothing, like Velasquez's Venus? I'd be less beautiful, not serene. My high stiletto on a man, as another gazes upon my legs from the bed he is chained. Nights like these continue, but only in this portrait of an imagination, now in your imagination a while. But I am most provocative as I close my eyes and picture extravagant captivities. My ear, your voice within, a body falling, a meaning, my hands opening on whatever they are holding.
Kimberly Taylor received her MFA in poetry from Columbia University, and she's the author of the chapbook Captivities. You know, when I read that book and that poem, I said to myself, this is fearless writing. That is the first thing that I thought. And I thought, this takes courage. This kind of writing takes courage. And I want to hear about that. What do you think you are saying using sensuality as a subtext? What is it that this poem right away introduces?
Well, fear has no business in my head. If I feel something coming in from a different consciousness, I banish it. And this poem has to do with feeling very much trapped in a body, a psyche, a mind, and a life. But there always is freedom right on the other side. If you think freedom and welcome it in, then
that,
you can reach
that.
It.
I love that, because you use sex as an allegory for being unafraid. And that's what this whole book is about. What is the title of this book?
Thin and Flying Dress.
And it is a beauty, too. Let's have another poem and we'll see if I'm right.
The Gliding Hour. Half-submerged in raw mists, I turn in upon the beak-chipped mollusk of myself. Finding nothing of use, I travel through the sea creature-spawned lace of my scream to the cloud forest and land atop a fir on Harbor Mountain. There, pressed into a hollow, is an 8-inch saw-wet owl, blind in one eye. She wants me to rise with her, but I tell her, some of us are not made to lift into the violet connecting evening to the mountains. Mm. We live close to the ground, error prone, able to hope only for small things arranged kindly, like the neat twin beds inside your childhood. I turn off the lamp between them, and see just enough. You, simply sleeping, your hair wild flowering forth in some far meadow where midnight pollinators strike the moon-stripped blooms. There is no concluding in the gliding hour, just the owl who gazes upon me with a single pupil of molten gold and sees what others cannot. That long ago, so I would never lose you, I found the proper shells, nests, and needles, and engraved your young face into my earth-brown eyes. Yes, it burned. It burned. But I received what a mother needs, a necessary blindness to go on.
I want to tell you, there are no two better stanzas written than those last two stanzas. They are so powerful. And I read that poem and I reread that poem and I said, what does this poem want? What does it want? It isn't asking for love. It is probing. It is a little disturbing. The owl with a single pupil, the harbor mountain, the gold, so many beautiful, beautiful satin images to conceal a conflict. So talk to me about this poem, because I know that it does not want to manipulate. I know it doesn't want to persuade. But what does it want?
Grace, you always ask the toughest questions. And I do appreciate you for that.
Would you agree that the imagery is pretty unusual, even if you wrote it?
Well,
wild flowering forth, moon stripping blooms.
Yes. If you knew my daughter and saw her hair, well, maybe I think you have. Mm-hmm. It's so long and flowing that it definitely wildflowers forth.
Right. So we have a speaker in the poem, and then we have a point of view, and there's obviously a recipient of these thoughts. So you use language, the lace of language, to conceal a pain. Painful. Something's painful going on here.
Yes, it's the pain of pride going before the fall.
Uh-oh.
Or the basic knowledge that motherhood is so tough.
Mm.
And when you think you understand something and you don't, you're at a loss. And that's what this poem is about.
That is what this poem's about. Talk about the mollusk.
Well, the mollusk is very, very ancient, and it's definitely an ancient creature, and it's been around for so long, yet it's very humble and small.
And beak-chipped. I mean, this is a beak-chipped mollusk is kind of a scary image for the speaker to say, I turn in upon the beak-chipped mollusk of myself. That's really powerful. That's a lot of pain right there.
Well, to be disappointed in the self is a lot of what this poem is about. And turning in for an inner resource, an inner knowledge, only to find it's not there.
Finding nothing of use.
Nothing of use.
Oh.
It's when the self fails the self in the middle of the need for insight.
Well, it is. The naked poem is dressed so beautifully.
Oh, thank
and
you.
That is what art does. Art saves. It is very complex, but the imagery and the nests, the proper shells, the nests and needles that engrave the young face, oh my. So you manage to say, no matter what we feel, I can make it beautiful. Do you believe that?
I do. After hearing you say that, I agree.
Well, I am startled by your work, and that's why I want to hear more. And I want everyone to know that you have poems in the Boston Review, the Hawaii Review, the Great River Review, Notre Dame Review, Pivot, Seneca Review, Samizdat, and many others. Her work appeared recently in New American Writing, which is the choice of the freshest voices of the year. Let's have another poem.
Thin and flying dress. You came down from the alpine to find me in the float house on Thorn Bay, where I lay like a plant of power, my green legs splayed under my thin and flying dress. Will you have me against the wall? It is your fault that I am here, dropped by the long midnight into this room with pine-willed walls, where outside a sea lion draped across the mooring ball measures my soul. Raven Mary gauges my darkness. To survive, I must drink of you, and after many pleasant conversations, I do, until I am in my finely sewn gown time, wild sister to throat-high lupine. You know, we have to go too far. When you are just a waist, twisting Judas, a form of no on the floorboards, thrilled by the sea, I will wish I had not done this.
Whoa. I want to talk about the way it looks on the page, because the reader cannot be here with us. First of all, it's a poem of motion. It moves very quickly. A lot of vowels that are, I call motion lotion. And it is without punctuation, which is interesting to me because that is not like the other poems. Also, it's very clear in three tercets so that even though the thought is kind of wild, the poem says someone's in charge of this. You're safe reading this. Talk about writing it because I thought, well, she did this all at once.
I actually had 50 drafts of this poem, and it took months and months, and it took many different forms until this form seemed to be right, sort of.
Why?
The control.
Why? What were you hoping for?
Well, I wanted to work with language's inner volatility and have it explode on the page at the same time that it speaks to the reader inside one's mind. So there would be surprise and combustibility
and a story.
And
so you didn't think you had that with the first draft?
No.
That is fascinating to me. And listen to the language you invent. I do until I am in my finely sewn gown time, all one word, wild sister to throat high lupine, and then twisting ludus, a form of no on the floorboards. You will do anything.
Yes, I will.
Absolutely. Like a plant of power, my green legs splayed under my thin and flying dress. You just take language and make it your own. What do you think you can do?
I love experimenting with language, and if something happens to come into my mind, and I just put it down.
And it looks perfect. There is not a lump under the mattress here. I think that's why it's the title poem.
Yeah.
Do you think so?
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
Does
definitely.
It embody the tone of what we're going to hear?
I think it does.
Well, we're going to find out. Kimberly Taylor is here. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this book will keep you riveted just because she has channeled language in a way that hasn't been done before. So let's hear one.
The Vineyardess of St. Helena. Earlier, the vineyardess rode her white mass horse hard, the morning candelabra breaking about her, the parched hills breaking churchfully about her thighs, suffused in the heat rising Jesus from her steed, the flanks lathering as she let the mare glide through the eyelashes of morning, the veils of eve adrift in the valley. Mostly she sleeps in one bedroom now, her husband in another. Sometimes she thinks there are others. Yes, there are men. Preferable to one reappearing love, she reasons, in the wine light of the crushed afternoon. Mm. Her husband works only the difficult horses, the racehorses boiling across the track in their summer gloss, long reined and riderless.
Give me a break, Kimberly. The thighs suffused in the heat rising Jesus from her steed, the flanks lathering as she let the mare glide through the eyelashes of morning, the veils of eve adrift. Give me a break. Where does that come from?
I actually was on a ranch observing a vineyardess and her husband, and it looked like they had a tricky marriage. And it was so beautiful there, and she had a white horse, and I drank so much wine there also.
In the wine light of the crushed afternoon, not the wine light of the afternoon, but the wine light of the crushed afternoon. So there's danger everywhere.
Yes. Yes.
There is, and you love it.
I love it.
You love to channel it and ride it like a horse.
Exactly.
So I thought that was a portrait of something you actually witnessed. Where is St. Helena?
It is in Napa Valley.
Oh.
And
did you ride a horse as well?
Not there, but I wanted to. I could have ridden there.
We're sure of that because I've read your stuff. I'm sure you want to do everything.
I do.
So is this saying what you wanted to say? Because the way you put words together, talk about enjambment.
Yes. Enjambment is when one line blends right into the other without a full stop at the end. And I love enjambment because it creates a rolling rhythm in the poem that wouldn't be there if there were periods at the end of each line. If there were periods at the end of the line would end, you would take a break and begin the next. But enjamb lines allow the language, for me, to my ear, just to flow much better, to kind of fly down the page.
When you put unlikely words together, what do you think happens?
I'm hoping that the words kind of get together and have more fun together than they would if they were separate.
So there's a playfulness
in doing that. Yes, maybe a magnetic attraction that they come together.
Well, I think you have that what John Ashbery has, and that is you are able to spark energy by unlikely combinations, by, I think once you called them collisions of words. I remember you saying that once someplace. Are you aware of that?
No, not exactly. No, I think if I was too aware, I would slow down and nothing would happen.
And then what would meaning be? I mean, we have to find meaning embedded in language here, which makes it a reason to read more than once. But it looks as if you don't think meaning is the top priority.
I do think meaning can be a trap or a cage of perception, which can influence what the poet is writing and what is being heard. And if I can outrace meaning with sound, then I still think the meaning comes through, but in a more effervescent way that's not linear.
That is exactly right, but I didn't know that. I knew that all of our lives we're trying to juggle meaning so that it isn't the main character in the poem. But can you say that again?
Probably not.
No, but it was right on. It was right on. And as I told someone, the famous anecdote about T.S. Eliot saying that meaning is the meat the burglar throws to the dog.
I love that.
So the burglar can get on with the real business.
That resonates with me.
I understand. And the real business is feeling. And the real business is feeling. And do you think we get that with your words?
I think that sound and sense are intermingled, and one can provoke the other. Not necessarily
sound.
The sound and the senses.
We are talking about The Thin and Flying Dress by Kimberly Taylor. And she has written one chapbook before and is also the publisher of one of America's finest magazines called Annapolis Home, which is a magazine of literary journalism and portraits of architecture and the new art in houses. But along with being a journalist, this happens. This happens. So she can be a businesswoman, and she can be a woman of beautiful mystery. And that's what we're uncorking today.
I never want to stop to think too hard about what I'm doing.
Where do you get all the words?
I just read a lot and collect a lot of phrases in my mind as I go throughout my day. Always just listening, even from a cereal box, a word will jump out at me, or a billboard, or comes from all kinds of places, even things that you've said to me, Grace.
Well, you know, that's what we call living twice, isn't it?
Yes.
The artist
yes.
gets to see things, and then she gets to say things.
Yes.
And then you invent different ways of saying things. So we're unpuzzling that. And for that reason, I love to go on and talk about the way you write. Read the next poem, and then we'll talk about more of your process, which is very individual, I think. Do you meditate into the air and dream and get dreamy? Or do you collect images every day?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And jot them down?
Yes, definitely.
Talk about that process of sitting down and wanting to start a poem. What does a feeling start with? Mine is melancholy.
Oh, okay. Yours is melancholy. Yeah.
When do you write? So it must come on a tone of feeling.
Yeah. Usually I write when I'm very, very relaxed. And usually it's just at night laying down in bed. And some words will just begin the poem. I'll just have a phrase and I'll just take off from there. And all of the stored images and ideas will just be poured in to whatever I'm writing, which then has to be winnowed away.
So you have a database.
No, that's, yeah, a database.
And then it just happens. But, you know, everybody does. But between there and the page quite a mystery.
It sure is. It is.
And it's very hard for us to articulate it right now, but I really want to because this is such unusual poetry. Read the next unusual poem.
This is called Chateau, after the story of O.
What was that about?
The story of O is an erotic, explicit novel about bondage and sex.
And how does that inspire you?
Well, it was the first book that was forbidden to me when I was 14 and my parents took our family to this little Caribbean island. I went to the bookshelf and I pulled out this book and my dad flew over, grabbed the book and said, "Oh, the story of O," and took it away.
No, naturally it would be.
Oh, yeah, I had to read it.
And so it made an indentation in your life. Some
it
people
did.
Start with the Bible, you know.
This was not the case. And it was written by a woman, which
yes.
fascinated me.
It's a famous book. It's a famous book. And here we're paying homage again to this first erotic book. And let's hear it.
Chateau. Many thoughts ago, why part woman and bird flowed down page into story of O, landing accidentally and wingfully on the ottoman in the castle blackness next to Sir Stephen, who was kissing his way down the body of O, who was straining at her cuffs. Why wondered at the cage and rack, hook and whip, the steel bars fretting the body of O in the weaveless afternoon? In the gleaming Diecekla, why flexed her wings whitely and sternly noticed that O, like Y, had the shortest possible name, was trapped a blood in the feminine locket? O revealed the line, sir, had carved down the middle of her life she did not want, preferred the subconscious chateau, its unexplained wedlocks and refrains. She would not be unfaithful to Sir, the guards. Surely, why understood that to be taken those many ways was the only relief. Still, why tried to launch upwind, to fly away with O. From afar, the guards wondered at what they saw. Two silhouettes reaching low text, one lightly feathered, speech passing in the frozen breeze.
How can a breeze be frozen? That is the whole poem.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom and freezing.
Exactly.
Well, how is it that all of your women who are captured are still in charge? They're still predominantly in charge. The irony here is that we don't feel that anything bad is happening because we know she's going to win out.
Exactly.
What does Y have to do with O?
Y is
the character.
Yeah, she is part bird, part woman. And she's sort of flying into this scene where O is bound and in a, you know, probably in a sex dungeon and chained. And she wants to help Y escape. But O does not want to escape.
That's interesting. So there's the conflict
exactly.
in the poem. And once again, you create words by putting them together in an unlikely way. Y wondered at the cage and rack, hook and whip, the steel bars fretting. That's all one word. The body of O in the weaveless afternoon. What is a weaveless afternoon? How does a person think of that? I mean, that doesn't come from you. You're just collecting stuff from the universe.
I think you can be trapped in your own mind.
Well, you've got a good place to be then. There's lots of fun in there. Let's have a final poem.
Okay. Among the doves. My sisters and I arrange ourselves among the doves at the feast end of the early blooming field. They promise to teach us their avian lies, how to take off our figures, become ground, four flowering avens, tines on the combine. All day we make ourselves into things, until the slant of the red barn roof just hints at sadness, until the dogs draw near, until all I want is a sister's hand, forms that hold, not the bare high plains of the hunter's face, rough hands that close upon our hair. I want what the doves knew before they left us, just their nests, those bride-sized bowls of salt grass and vetch. They don't look back to see our bodies lined up in a row in gun-worn air, held fast in broken arms of grass.
That is the voice of Kimberly Taylor.
Thank you.
The Thin and Flying Dress, Thin and Flying Dress, don't forget it. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, and friends of the program, Natalie Canavore and Sandy Jackson-Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer. I'm Grace Cavalieri.